trying to get started.
Yep, let's come back around here. So, as I began the last session, kind of putting a punctuation mark on the world that Elvis made, sort of culminating in the Beatles. But this impulse, what I call the folk impulse, continued in some interesting ways during the 1960s and into the 1970s. And so we see lots of not only social protest, like I was highlighting, but also artistic experimentation and lifestyle experimentation. So this song, for example, this is going to be number 11 on the lyric sheet. From the Jefferson Airplane. So this song is about Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, Go Ask Alice, and it also highlights the drug culture at the time and experimentation. There was also a serious pushback on that 1950s consensus culture that, for reasons that I was discussing last night, were dissatisfying and wasn't supplying the answers to young people who were recognizing hypocrisies and that sort of thing. It opened up all kinds of experimentation and all kinds of new lifestyles. So with sexual experimentation, with drug experimentation, and with drugs, and especially hallucinogenic drugs, were deemed as perhaps an access into new insights, not just recreationally. And so we see songs like this emerging. This is White Rabbit, Jefferson Airplane.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small. And the one that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she can be born. And if you go chasing a rabbit, you know you're going to fall. Tell him I'm a smoking caterpillar, and I'll
give you a call. The pills that mother gives you just don't do anything.
When the men are rich and poor, get up and tell you.
One thing to notice about that song, and with many other songs like California Dreamin', this is not the soundtrack to a dance. You just listen to the music and it's being treated like an art form rather than a party soundtrack. Now the party soundtrack impulse is going to continue, but the artistic expression is going to also take flight. And by all accounts, the apogee of this is going to be the Beatles once again. So we've got the Beatles reaching that high point of what I call the first era, but they're going to get exhausted from touring after 1965, and they just stopped touring. If you know anything about Beatlemania, it was a horrible crucible for them to have been in, basically as prisoners in their own lives, because of the throngs and crowds that and the publicity surrounding them. So they went into seclusion and just made studio music. And having determined to stop touring, they decided that they would create sort of a faux band, a band out of their imagination, and create a concept album that sort of imitates a concert. And this band is Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And so the Beatles then are in the studio role-playing a touring band. And it becomes one of what's regarded as the high point of what I would say the second era of music that's socially aware but also trying to take itself seriously, unlike Chuck Berry, unlike Elvis Presley, as trying to be serious as an art form. So this is a little documentary.
Just spot. Like another Beatles album.
And we've got interviewing from each of the Beatles here.
Opportunity. We could do anything we wanted. I went on a trip to America and came back and had this idea on the plane. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It was all very Uncle Joe's Medicine Show with Dancing Bears and Elixir of Life. You know, those kind of jokey type. Everything about the album will be imagined from the perspective of these people. So it doesn't have to be us. It doesn't have to be the kind of song you want to write. It could be the song they might want to write.
We were in this big white room that was very dirty. It hadn't been painted for years and years. And it had all this old sound baffles hanging down that was all dirty and broken. Not a very nice atmosphere when you think of the songs that were made in that studio. It's amazing because there was no atmosphere in there. We had to kind of just make the atmosphere ourselves.
We were really spending a long time in the studio. And we were still doing the basic tracks like we always did. And then it would take weeks for the overdubs, you know, for the string, whatever they thought, you know, the writers. And, you know, Sgt. Pepper for me was great because it's a fine album. It's a fine album, but I did learn to play chess on it.
Well, I just had to learn that. I saw the photograph.
By the time Pepper had come along, I suppose I was a realizer of their ideas, so that if John wanted something really weird, I had to try and provide it. Or if Paul wanted some extraordinary orchestration, I had to try and find out what he wanted.
We just grew through those years together, him as the straight man and us as the loonies, but you know, he was always there for us to interpret our strangeness.
Was our grandest endeavor. It gave everybody, including myself, a lot of leeway to come up with ideas, doing different stuff. You know, what used to happen, whoever wrote the song would then play it on guitar or piano, and we would all put in our input. I mean, it was fabulous in that way, it was being a band.
Prior to that time period that I'm talking about, this mid-60s here, after folk enters and crosses over into rock and roll and transforms it, a recording, an album, would basically be performers doing pretty much what they would do on stage, maybe with a little bit more care and attention, but what they would do on stage with the microphones.
It was going to be boring, so just make another big sound.
We'd
stop touring.
What we start seeing now is the studio itself as being one of the places of
producing
the sound. I went on a trip
to America, came back. And have this
where
idea
you're not just playing
playing
the instruments, but the arranging and the manipulation of
it. It was all very
Uncle
Joe's medicine
part of
show
the music creation process. And the Beatles really reached the high point of that. There were other examples of that too. They weren't alone in this. A good famous example of this also is this came out just shortly before Sgt. Pepper. But this Beach Boys song here.
And the way the sunlight plays upon her head.
Brian Wilson, the main songwriter of the Beach Boys, is also they're kind of a party band in some respects, but also very they took themselves seriously as artists too. This song goes through movements. It's got deliberate segments. It's not simply like stanza chorus. It's very different.
Softly smile, I know she must be proud. In her eyes, she goes with me through a blocking room.
I'm picking up her vibration. She's giving me her salvation. I'm fighting back.
This segment of the song is interesting. It would have been unheard of 10 years earlier. Again, the song goes through movements. It's not great balls of fire or anything like that. If you were driving around in 1967, going through the radio dial in your car in late 1967, chances are you would have encountered Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band being played. That was a fascinating album. It was the only album for which the Beatles didn't release a single. The only Beatle album for which they didn't release a single. It was meant and released as a whole set, like a concert theme album. And it was received that way, and a lot of disc jockeys did something, radio disc jockeys did something that would, again, have been unheard of, would play the entire album through uninterrupted, which is not something that disc jockeys would do. It made the cover of Time magazine shortly after it came out. An excerpt from there was a long expose on Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Time saw it as a historical event. But it says, includes this remark, messengers from beyond rock and roll, they, the Beatles, are creating the most original, expressive, and musically interesting sounds being heard in pop music. They're leading an evolution in which the best of current post-rock sounds are becoming something that pop music has never been before, an art form. Serious musicians are listening to them and marking their work as a historic departure in the progress of music, of any music. And I've looked at, college textbook surveys of music history, several of them have a little couple of pages on Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which is interesting. So it's an interesting development as we move into the second era of rock and roll. Pop music is going to emerge, of course, in, I mean, that's the 1960s. We've got lots of time that spans between then and now, and I don't have time today to go through every step through that. But I wanted to walk through that to show once again that songs and music, along with other items of cultural production, always reflect their time and circumstances, technology, socially, culturally, that sort of thing. Not just morally. Sometimes we Christians tend to be reductionists and ask only the moral question and lose a lot of our ability to read cause and effect and the flow of influence, because influence flows in other ways, just in technological environments, social environments, that sort of thing. And of course, we need to be acutely aware of the moral sense, but oftentimes there's something immoral that can smuggle in because we don't know the flow of cause and effect, the flow of influence, that sort of thing. But Solomon in Proverbs 7 tells us that the where, the when, the context, in addition to the moral message, is very important for students, for kids, for your children to understand. Come alongside them and talk about this. All right, so I want to move beyond this and try to reflect even more broadly on what's happening here. We've talked about music and other things that are happening in the 1950s and 60s. But I want to talk or answer the question how modern pop culture works. My goal is this afternoon to move into postmodern culture. And we could go back, of course, to the turn of the 20th century and even before then, when we harness steam, which is going to enable us to overcome geographical boundaries. Steamships move cargoes along waterways with increasing ease and with a regularity that could be reliably scheduled rather than depending on winds and things like that. Engineers dug canals and dredged natural waterways to facilitate more efficient water transport. And then when we harness steam along the ground, we can power cargo over land as well, along railroads that builders constructed with remarkable pace. They designed tunnels, bridges that carried railroads through mountains, over valleys and waterways, things that previously had been barriers to markets, that sort of thing. Throughout the 19th century, the total mileage of railroads in the United States increased every decade by more than 70% over the decade that preceded it. Railroads and steamships brought raw materials from faraway places into great manufacturing centers, and then things were manufactured and then carried back to the faraway places to their markets, distant markets. And then telegraph wires spanned those same distances so you can have communication. A fellow in 1912 described this scene here as a new scene. And this is from way back in time now to 1912, over 100 years ago. And he says, in the old days, each manufacturing company, like each tradesman, had an advantage in his own neighborhood based on the fact that the cost and difficulties of transportation were so great that competitors from a distance were, to a large extent, handicapped in his territory. That makes sense? The people in your town are going to manufacture and service the people in their town, and the people in the next town over are going to have a hard time breaking in because it's so laborious to get the materials across ground, over land, that sort of thing. But this had changed by the time, by the turn of the 20th century. I've been talking about media here. The effect that this has on media and communication is going to be pretty drastic. Around the turn of the 20th century, mass printing and advertising is going to come of age. In the 1890s, a few publishers discovered that they could make more money from advertisements than from paid subscriptions. More money from advertisements than from paid subscriptions. And this adds to the motivation to reach as many readers as possible. The key people who figured this out were rival newspapermen, William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer, who had rival newspapers in New York City, each trying to outdo the other. And these two individuals, in their rivalry, went to remarkable lengths to expand their circulation for daily newspapers. Because you see, if you make a lot of money from subscribers, then the more you can charge them, the better, right? But if you make more money from advertisers, if my newspaper goes to 100 people, then my advertisement is worth so much. But if my newspaper goes to 1,000 people, then I can sell that same ad space for a lot more, right? And so they want to boost circulation. And in order to do that, they drop prices. And prices went down, so that they could charge more to the advertisers. It's a change in the business model that emerged in the 1890s. And then coming out of the turn of the 20th century then, this business model is the dominating business model. The number of unique newspapers after 1915 began to decrease because newspapers would merge to expand circulation, right? But circulation rose. So the number of different newspapers decreased, but overall circulation was rising. Magazines experienced the same thing. By the early 1920s, there were 773 different daily newspapers, representing a daily circulation of 24.77 million across the United States. And magazines followed a similar trend. Thanks to railroads early in the 1890s, magazines were reaching what for the first time could be truly called a national audience. And I'd like you to think about that, a national audience. You can't think about a national audience without railroads, telegraphs, steamships back behind a national audience that stretched coast to coast. It was a marvel of production and distribution. In the same decade, the 1890s, a lot of the well-edited, well-illustrated magazines lowered their prices. Some were 35 cents per copy. They lowered them to 15 cents and lowered them again to 10 cents and eventually 5 cents a copy. And the drop in prices, again, reflected that same shift in the business model. By the time we get to 1920, most magazines are going to have half their space dedicated to advertising. Half their print space dedicated to advertising. And this brings us to people like this. Charles Dana Gibson, an illustrator. I want to talk about pretty girls. Charles Dana Gibson was a famous illustrator during this time, one of the best known illustrators, and his line drawings of young women were regarded, they came to be called Gibson girls. Some of you remember watching Anne of Green Gables. You might remember Anne's getting all decked out and her friends said, "Anne, you look like a Gibson girl." Right? And this is a Gibson girl. It becomes this iconic image, and there's Gibson, you know, it's the way to draw a girl. But we wind up with interesting developments. So here's a Los Angeles Herald from 1905. Now, Charles Dana Gibson did his work back east, but there's a special interest story. Has Los Angeles got a Gibson girl? Because images of these drawings of women are circulating in these magazines, and then we have a local situation in Southern California, and they're asking the question, do our girls look like that? I want you to ponder that for a moment and what that means. Our understanding of what a girl looks like and what constitutes prettiness is not the girls that you experience, that you run into as you walk around and bump into day in and day out. Your idea of what a pretty girl is has transformed, isn't it? And you're drawing that idea from another source that is shared from coast to coast, rather than the pretty girl in this community, the pretty girl in this community. I know some pretty girls. How do you understand and think about what a pretty girl is? The fact that they're, and so then there are some Los Angeles socialites. They're comparing, is she like a Gibson girl or not? Yeah, this one's more like a Gibson girl. This one's more like, yeah, we've got some pretty girls here in Los Angeles because they're like Gibson girls. But I want you to think about the very idea of where we get the idea of a pretty girl from is being transformed. It's being totally transformed. And so we have, here's another one. This is from a St. Louis paper, again, 1905, The American Girl Face. And it's go on. I have my college students read this. They love this. It gives advice for how to make your face into an American girl face. There's, you know, blackheads. You have to spat your cheeks, or you take a couple of fingers and you go like this and rosy. In order to, that's right, and stretch it and that sort of thing. Actually, it's, and it's best if you get your fingers a little bit wet and then you scratch your cheek off. But they're chasing after an image that they see in by the illustrators, guys like Charles Dana Gibson and their other well-known illustrators during that time. One of them is James Montgomery Flagg, who did the famous "I Want You" World War I poster. He also did a lot of like pin-up nude pictures and that sort of thing too. The same, but he was one of the famous illustrators. Also did magazine illustrations. But this is, we start to get this idea of, this is a pretty girl. The pretty girl is what is in the media rather than something that you've actually met. And you ascertain or start to evaluate something that you've actually experienced in your day-to-day living by what you have in the media. That was developing in the 19-teens and 20s, and I want you to recognize that it is new and unique and different. We haven't seen this before in history. You can't explain this apart from steam power and telegraphs and the whole modern infrastructure that creates this certain idea of what a pretty girl is. And this way of communicating what a pretty girl is. And that's important to recognize. Now, I'll have more to say about this later, but this is a good interlude for some parenting thoughts. First of all, to historicize this, to hopefully take some of the mystique out of it a little bit. But this has created what I'm describing for you has created a long legacy of insecurities among young people. And we're still living with it today. This interesting idea of beauty that is communicated from someone else and then becomes shared. I mean, it's always a community development. What is beauty, right? But what is the community that you're participating in when you get your ideas of beauty? Where are you coming from? That sort of thing. We just live in this environment that emerged in the early part of the 20th century. Its long legacy is still with us today. And I will say this, dads, your daughters are in this environment still. And you know, your wife grew up in this environment, and you inhabit this environment. And I will say this, your girls need to think about or think more highly of what you think about them than other sources are going to think about them. And that is a parenting responsibility. And the media is out there communicating what beauty is and is not. It's just a reality. And you've got a rival voice. And your daughters are not going to get away from it. You're kidding yourself if you think they are. So, girls, your girls need love, attention, and affection. I would say especially from dad. They also need some approval from mom. But when your little girl's little, dads, you need to hug her a whole lot. A whole lot. Draw her close to you on the couch when you read a book to her or to watch a show. And be physical with her. When she gets older, you need to keep up the hugs and you need to continue holding hands. And once she gets a little older and she's going to start to become a woman, even Dad's going to feel a little awkward then. Right, Dad? A lot of dads feel uncomfortable being physical with their daughters. Well, what do you do with that discomfort? It's not altogether bad. You need to respect the fact that she is, among other things, a woman. Right? So, and you're a man, so let the discomfort inform healthy boundaries with your teenage girls. Don't be the creeper dad, right? So maybe pulling her onto your lap or wrestling with her or tickling her the way you did when she was little, maybe that might be get a little weird. Now, I think most dads, though, are afraid of being weird dad, and so they fall into the other ditch and do nothing, and you can't do that, especially now. Especially now. Don't fall into the opposite ditch and refrain altogether from being physical with her, dads. Don't avoid healthy father-daughter affection. There should be physical contact, dads, between you and your daughters, and this is your job. This is your job. It signals, it should be different than with other girls. It's like signaling, like, you're my daughter. Because I'm physical with you in a way that I'm not physical with someone else's daughter. And of course, I'm not physical with you in a way that I am with my wife either. You need to learn how to negotiate those boundaries. There should be a difference between your displays of affection for other young women, which is basically hands off, and that's what's appropriate, and your affection for your own daughter, which includes touching, certainly appropriate touching. You don't treat her just like any other girl because she's your girl, and you're signaling that all along. And if you feel awkward, then get over it. Remember that she feels awkward too, which is why you need to take the lead. Because she lives in this environment, and girls are just insecure because they are sent messages like, this is the pretty face, from all kinds of sources. So we should get very concerned in a community like this if you have, say, a little 4-year-old girl, 6, 8, 9-year-old girl, and, you know, two families get together, and the young girl is always around the other dad, seeking out, you know, hungry for that masculine affection. That's a sign that her dad is not filling her tank the way he needs to. So, I know of one gentleman, very wise man, who was hospitable, would have different families over, and there was a little girl who was probably about 4 or 5 that brought this family over, and he sat down on the couch, and she would be right next to him, like, bring a book, read, snuggle, nuzzle, and it was kind of, but she needed that snuggle, nuzzle from some guy, and she wasn't getting it from her dad. So she's going after other guys. What's that going to grow up into? She's going to be trouble when she's 17. You need to pay attention to the things that are going to make your kids feel a little bit insecure. The Listerine Company in the 1920s came up with a brilliant campaign. It was this tonic that could be applied to a number of things, but they hired out an ad agency and an ad agency that said, well, it's particularly good for bad breath. And so they invented a term that did not arise from the medical community, but from an ad agency, halitosis. Halitosis is the medical term for bad breath. And it makes you unpopular. Look at the picture here, though. I love this. So you got the couple in the background, but in the foreground, and as you go on and read through the narrative here, she doesn't know why she doesn't get danced with too much. You know, it could be her halitosis. I don't know. As you sit down with your kids, I would encourage you to all the time make it a regular feature when you're driving down the road, when there's some pop-up ad on the internet, when you're watching TV and there's some kind of pop-up ad, then work with them to tell the story. Tell the story. That's what's happening back in Proverbs chapter 7. The dad in Proverbs 7 is like, look at the pretty girl on the corner. Watch the guy coming. Yeah, watch the story. How's the story play out? Okay. And almost all advertising, there are some exceptions, but the exceptions are rare, tell a story about a vision for the good life, and then there's the potential consumer, there's you, and there's the good life, and the story of achieving the good life is by means of purchasing the product. So the good life. The good life is coupled up, having a guy on your arm, being on a guy's, you know, your arm and a guy's arm, and there's you, and by Listerine, which is the means to the good life, right? You see that? Most advertisements present a vision for the good life. Like, what's the good life according to the ad? What's the good life? And then, of course, you know, you imagine yourself vicariously through maybe one of the characters in the ad so that you'll attain the good life. So your pathway toward, you know, a bunch of guys having a lot of fraternal camaraderie, and you achieve that through Miller beer. The consumption of Miller beer is the guys in the bar with their... So that's the good life, right? And then, now, I would encourage you to make it just a constant feature, because storytelling happens around your kids all the time. Do you teach your kids to read stories? Do you teach your kids to read the stories all around them? You need to do that. You need to do that. So you, the product, and you attain the good life, right? But it's always that narrative arc. There's a vision for a good life. Here's where you are. Somehow you're distant from the good life, and it creates a need, for a sense of need. Absent, somehow there's something that you desire that you might lack, and you fulfill your lack by means of purchasing the product. Okay? So Listerine again. So you got a lack. What's the good life? And you got a girl who hasn't had a guy come around. And then she sees images like this, she's missing out on the good life. And she may not become a Listerine buyer. In fact, a lot of people aren't taken in by ads to simply complete the purchase, right? She may not buy Listerine, but a story was told nonetheless. A lot of young ladies would look at this and get all cynical, like, yeah, Listerine, right? And we all kind of laugh at it. But there's a vision of good life, and it fosters an insecurity. Maybe the good life is just hanging out with dad and with your family. And you can demystify it and take its power away by just recognizing and having the ability to tell that story. What's the story of the good life? Okay. Playing up your insecurities. All right. Let's see. This advertisement. I'll read you some of the text here. Most of the girls of her set were married, but not Eleanor. It was beginning to look, too, as if she never would be. True, men were attracted to her, but their interest quickly turned to indifference. Poor girl. She hadn't the remotest idea why they dropped her so quickly. And even her best friend wouldn't tell her. No toothpaste kills germs like this instantly, but Listerine will change that. All right. Now, this is Mary Pickford. In the 1920s, we can also add radio and cinema into the mix of print. I've been highlighting print here. And this new mass media fostered popular attachment not only to certain products and visions for the good life, but the vision for the good life got attached to people in interesting ways. not only did products become commodities within a growing mass consumer culture, but people became commodities, certain people. They became well-known brands in and of themselves. This is what we identify as celebrities. Mass media offered a new means of social connection that appealed to a lot of ordinary people who found themselves more and more in the rising cities of the 1920s, where in a world that was treating them as nameless, interchangeable parts. The experience of loneliness in a crowd was an experience of the modern world. And a lot of people sought escape from the anonymity that they felt, where, you know, you're in a city, you interact with people all the time, none of whose names you know. And they're people that you don't know and haven't seen. They're all strangers, and you're amidst of them. There's an interesting kind of loneliness around other people that fosters, right? Among the experiences that people began to share and form a sense of community around, if you're lonely in a crowd, is to have a public conversation around certain individuals who we'll call celebrities, that you could sort of participate vicariously through them. And so if I see myself in them, they become projections of my aspirations, my ideals, and that sort of thing. And it helps me get through being lonely in a crowd. Does that make sense? And so there was a proliferation of celebrities. You did not have, you had well-known people prior to this time, but the celebrity is a uniquely modern phenomenon. Alexander the Great was not a celebrity. Thomas Jefferson was not a celebrity. He was a well-known person, but he was not a celebrity, which is the kind of interesting media-projected person that I'm talking about here. All right. One commentator in 1932 said this. He refers to certain individuals whose personalities have caught the imagination of mankind. And he goes on to describe celebrities emerging when ordinary individuals lose their sense of who they are amidst the vast sea of modern society, and so they turn to new media in an effort to restore their own identity. Today, he says, the very mechanism which reduces the average man to a standardized robot seeks to pick out an exception here and there and make him conspicuous. These exceptional people are products of, he says, the facility with which the radio, the press, the screen fastens upon some personal characteristic or attribute of people like Mary Pickford. When Rudolph Valentino died, he died early, famous actor, and he was a heartthrob. He died. When he died, I think the year was 1927, there were dozens of suicides among young women because they saw themselves as attached to Rudolph Valentino. When the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped, the Lindberghs got all of these personal notes that were very personal about, you know, praying for you or concerned about your baby and this is tragic and so on. And that became one of the trials of the century, about the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby in the late 1920s. But it's kind of bizarre that people would feel induced to write a personal letter of care to someone they've never met. That shows that they've got some sort of personal bond to Charles Lindbergh. That's just bizarre, isn't it? But that's what celebrities are. They're celebrities that foster this kind of pseudo relationship, a vicarious participation. And you have to have a vicarious participation because you don't have a real experience, a real lived embodied experience with the real people around you. And so you have these weird ideas about what a pretty face is and what's socially acceptable and that sort of thing, oftentimes embodied in these persons. All right. So that's what celebrities are. I love this article. What is it? This is from 1926, and these are people who have it. And the author is trying to explain what it is. and actually can't explain what it is, but these people have it. And really what they have is the fact that they're on public notice, and other people, the reason why certain people get famous is because you and I in the third person are talking about that person. And that's what makes them a celebrity, is you and I and one another are talking about them. And so we've made them into a celebrity. All right. So I guess I'll leave it at that. These dynamics with celebrities, ideals, visions of the good life, talk about this with your kids. The way to talk about it with your kids is to interrogate questions. When you see somebody well-known on TV, you know, when someone says, like, I hate Joe Biden, what do you mean by that? What is hatred? What is your relationship to Joe Biden? And ask your kids that. And work through the conversation with them about, you know, what are you talking about with social relations? Where do you draw your cues? That sort of thing. That plays out differently than someone I know that I hate, isn't it? And talk about this with your kids. Help them, teach them to deconstruct, and it'll help them to sort of demystify the images that are all around them, the impulses and instincts that are all around them. What's the vision for the good life? What's the storytelling? Don't be the dad who says, don't look at that ad. Be the dad who says, let's look at this ad. Hey, you know, the advertisements should be a big part of the TV watching experience. Gather the family around, like Solomon, Proverbs 7, right? Hey, let's watch this, vision for the good life. Does it make you feel insecure, honey? Oh, and she'll say, if she's 12 and 13, they're trying to, aren't they? Yeah, I can see they're, you know, the game is up. You want your kids to be able to read things like that, right? So, there you go. All right. So, we'll leave it there. Lots more to come on that, but it's time for a break now. What's that? Pray for lunch? Sure. And I understand we've got some food coming, so let's give thanks for the food. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, you are good and righteous and faithful, and you are the faithful Father to your people, even to your people who had been previously estranged, and you've brought us into your household, and you feed your people well. We thank you for the food that we're about to enjoy. We thank you for the fellowship we enjoy around this food, knowing that it's a foretaste of the glories that one day await us as your children at your table. We thank you and commit our day to you in Jesus' name. Amen.